Okay, it is October 5th, 2010. We are interviewing Mr. Jim Chanos from Kynikos Associates. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Mr. Chanos, my name is Chris Seifer. With me is Julie Marcacci. We're from the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We were established by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009 that directs us to figure out the various causes of the financial crisis and deliver a report to Congress by the end of this year, December 15th. We have been talking to many people over the last year, getting their views on causes of the financial crisis, and we thought it made a lot of sense to talk to you too, given your background in the industry. So with that, could you please just summarize your educational and work background since college, and then we'll get to the substance of the interview.
Yes, my name is Jim Chanos. Since 1985, I've been the principal managing partner of Kynikos Associates. Prior to that, I received a bachelor's degree from Yale University in 1980 in politics and economics. After that, I was employed by Blythe Eastman Payne Weber in Chicago, followed by stints at Guilford Securities in Chicago and Deutsche Bank in New York. I formed Kynikos in 1985 to basically provide short selling services for private clients through partnerships, offshore investment corporations, and managed accounts. Kynikos currently runs slightly under $7 billion in assets globally.
Okay, great. So let's just hop right to it. The statute that created us, lists a bunch of areas for us to look at in terms of potential causes of the financial crisis, and I'll probe you about some of those. But why don't you give us your opinions or views on what you feel were the main causes of the financial crisis, if you would, please.
Well, I think that the main cause of the financial crisis was a combination of skewed incentives, which was aided and abetted by compromised rating agencies and flawed, if not fraudulent, accounting. And all of those basically created a witch's brew of large amounts of leverage in instruments which very few understood, and those who did understand them, in my opinion, did not account for them properly on their balance sheets and income statements, thus allowing large amounts of bonuses and, in effect, capital to be siphoned out of the system into private hands, and thus accelerating the collapse once economic forces jolted the real estate market.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, what were the skewed incentives that led to that?
Well, in my view, and I think it's substantiated by some of the figures we've seen at Lehman and other places that where there's been a cleanup effort involved, is that as the mortgage industry transformed from a credit to a securitization credit and hold model to a securitization model, the final resting place of the securitizations, particularly those that were the most problematic, the so-called toxic tranches, ended up residing in institutions that couldn't sell them. And it's my view that, in large part, those instruments were not accounted for properly on the books of the commercial banks and investment banks that held them, and consequently, profits were overstated almost immediately during the period 05, 06, and 07 at those banks, allowing large amounts of profits to be distributed to the partners and executives of those firms, with the taxpayer on the hook when the realization dawned that those pieces of paper were worth nowhere near what the executives and the risk managers had said they were. There was no prudent amount of reserving against those pieces of paper. We saw the flip side of that with AIG, in which it was not prudently setting up liability reserves for the contracts it was writing. But in the case of Lehman and others, the instruments that they could not sell or had to take back in the deals stayed on their books often at 100 cents on the dollar or 95 cents on the dollar, when by early 2007 it was very apparent that those instruments were already probably worthless. And that, to me, was the bezel, if you will, to use John Kenneth Galbraith's term, in the crisis. That was the heart of the crisis, was that poor accounting or lax accounting or even fraudulent accounting allowed the industry to show a level of health that it never really had.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had mentioned that not accounting properly for these from 2005 through 2007. I can tell you from some of the things I've looked at and other folks here, excuse me, you certainly see the market turn in late 06 and into 07 when home prices actually start to decline after their rate of growth had reduced. When you see more and more subprime originators failing or choosing to go out of business or being acquired, when you see the ABX indexes starting to go down, etc. Is it your view that the fraudulent or flawed accounting and the misreporting of these mortgage securitization assets was a problem before the late 06, early 2007 time frame?
Well, we know that we started to see the level of disclosure increase in the first quarter of 2007, as we've previously discussed. But what that it gave us the year end 2006 figures, which also had as a starting point the balance sheet for 2005.
Right.
So we could see the increase in 2006 in the level 2 and level 3 assets, and we could see the absolute levels in 05, which were already considerably large. So that's why I feel pretty confident making that statement.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of the matter was, it's my view in analyzing the issue and talking to people contemporaneously, that the reason a lot of these banks held the final tranches, the Z tranches, the toxic, whatever you want to call it, was that they simply were unsaleable, that hedge funds and other private investors didn't want to buy them, even in 05 and 06 when things looked good. So right away that should have told risk managers and others that they should have taken substantial discounts on the retained interests, or that which they put off balance sheet in SIVs and other things. And if they were unsaleable, they were unsaleable for a reason. The price was too high.
Mm-hmm.
And that again, to me, should have been the first warning signs to the players in this mortgage chain that something was wrong, that there was someone who was having to warehouse the most problematic pieces of paper in a model in which all of the pieces of paper were supposedly distributable. And that, in fact, this wasn't a free lunch as a lot of people had believed it was, and that therefore the people that were getting the ride on the AAA on a very bad bunch of paper, the flip side was the system was taking enormous risks on the back end sides of the piece of paper, but not accounting for it properly, and that accounting fiction drove things faster and faster into 06 and 07.
Mm-hmm. And let me try to probe you a little on timing. I can tell you from some companies we've looked at in terms of seeing the increase in retained interest, whether it's subordinate tranches or super senior tranches.
Yes.
of various types of securitizations. We see that happening and accelerating in late 06 and into 07. And we've seen documents where, as you said, they are retaining those positions, one, because traditional buyers like hedge funds and insurance companies are no longer buying it, and two, because whoever they can sell it to, they can't sell it at a price they're willing to sell it at, which implies that less than par, because they don't want to take a loss. And what I was hoping that you might know is perhaps your clients or other hedge funds, when did, in your opinion, did the hedge funds and other traditional buyers of CDO tranches stop buying them?
I think really we were not active in that market. We are an equity shop that focuses on the short side, but we certainly were monitoring it because we were short a number of financial institutions and home builders because of what we saw going on in on the front end of this problem, which was the bidding up of houses for people who couldn't afford them and credit being extended to people that really couldn't service the debt. So we came at it from that end of the telescope, but I can say that probably the most prescient people we talked to in this industry began talking to us about a problem in the securitization market about this in late 2006. But it wasn't really, I couldn't confirm it quantitatively and empirically until really we began seeing the new FAS 157 disclosures in March and April of 2007. And at that point then, others who were involved in this market were pointing out the deterioration in the ABX market, the HSBC announcement about household, which was a credit we knew something about. We were short household international early in the millennium and knew a little bit about their portfolio, and so on and so forth. New Century, problems at New Century. So that was all really in the December 06, February 07 time frame when this really became an issue amongst hedge funds and short sellers that began talking about the cracks that were appearing now, you know, sort of weekly in the residential real estate market.
Mm-hmm. And before FAS 157 required disclosures of level 1, 2, and 3 assets, how transparent, if that's the right word, were the financial statements of whether it's an investment bank or a commercial bank or a mortgage company like Countrywide or others about the level of retained interest they had on their books? Was that evident just from looking at a Q or a K?
No, there really wasn't very much. In speaking in aggregate, there wasn't very good disclosure. We kept looking for smoking guns, and just until we got that FAS disclosure, there really wasn't any way to tell.
Okay.
I think a couple of companies had, as I recall, qualitatively had comments in management's discussion and footnotes, but it was nothing. You clearly didn't get the magnitude, and the market didn't grasp the magnitude until the spring of 07 when these figures began being published. And then it was as if someone rang a bell, because almost immediately upon the publication of these numbers, journalists began writing about it, and hedge funds began talking about it, and it became, people began speaking about it in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that the catalyst for that, what was FAS 157, or was it FAS 157 along with the other things we've been talking about?
It was the combination of the two. Mm-hmm. It was the combination of people noticing the ABX, the news flow that was beginning, and then the FAS disclosures, which were, you know, eye-popping in terms of the amount of leverage that the banks and investment banks had in their level 2 and level 3 exposure. This well preceded the Bear Stearns hedge fund blow up. I mean, a lot of people, you know, put the beginning of the crisis at that point, late, whatever that was, June, I guess, of 07.
Right.
But things were definitely falling apart before that.
Mm-hmm. Did you notice, since you're running a fund that helps other folks short, did you notice an increase in interest at that time? You know, I guess in the February-March time frame, for a lot of the investment banks had November year ends.
Right.
So they were probably reporting these level 2 and 3 assets in the February time frame, at least in their Ks. I don't know if they disclosed it in their earnings releases. But did you see any kind of increase or spike in activity from folks that?
We definitely noticed that suddenly we had a lot of company in the real estate area, and that we had begun then looking at the financial institution. Now most of them were so large that there was never any issue in the borrowability, for example, of shares. Lehman was borrowable right up until its last days, for example. I know Mr. Fold likes to talk about the naked shorts in his stock, but it's yet another indication that Mr. Fuld had generally no idea what was going on in the marketplace. But by and large, the large financial institutions, there was never any difficulty in the borrow market. In fact, short activity still remained, you know, for many of the large institutions, a small part of the trading volume every day. But we did notice it in things like the mortgage brokers, mortgage bankers, home builders, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
People began either trying to directionally short the market or hedge off, which is usually more the case, you know, their existing embedded long positions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is Julie. You said that there was no issue with borrowing. Did it get more expensive? It was a little bit cost prohibitive?
Yes. I think the rates did go up for some of the institutions. But again, I mean, you could borrow the shares of these institutions, you know, pretty much, you know, throughout the crisis. Fannie Mae, Bear Stearns, Lehman.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you about a few things in your 10 lessons from the financial crisis presentation in October of 2009. See if I can just get some additional color on
sure.
some of these factors. Your first. Or I guess your lessons. Your first lesson is borrowing short and lending long is still a bad idea. And your PowerPoint deck slide talks about duration gaps and that short-term funding is not always rolled, which we certainly saw in the crisis.
Right.
But any additional color on that? Let me mention one thing. We have seen documents that indicated, I think, that folks in the government and certainly within the investment banks were somewhat surprised that secured repo financing was not being rolled, even though the collateral was treasuries and agencies. Was that something that was surprising folks on the street like yourself?
Well, that you know, that would certainly be a surprise, and that was not what we were talking about. And that you know. That was probably toward the end of the crisis, I assume.
Well, it happened with Bear, so I mean.
Well, it's okay.
Yeah.
but what I'm referring to was, you know, the mismatch in if you just looked at highly liquid securities in governments and repos and netted that off against your short-term liabilities, what was the mismatch in level two and level three securities to equity and subordinated debt and term financing.
Mm-hmm.
And even, I think we did analysis, even Goldman Sachs, which probably ran its book better than anybody else and was positioned correctly, you know, as we think we know. I think at one point we saw that even they had a $5 billion gap in terms of level two and level three net assets, net of liabilities, and their funding. So, i.e., they were funding $5 billion of level two and level three securities with short-term money, and the numbers were worse at the other institutions. So, forgetting anomalies and clearly market-shaking behavior like the inability to roll over secured repos, I'm talking about a Lehman-type situation, a Bear-type surge, or Merrill-type situation where they were holding on to toxic tranches and private equity stubs and things like that and derivative contracts and financing them in the overnight market.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's just insane. I mean, that's banking 101.
Right. Now, your second lesson is accounting matters a lot, and we've already talked about level two and level three assets and mark-to-model fantasy. But one thing we haven't talked about that you have on this PowerPoint deck is mark-to-market accounting, which is actually specifically referenced in our statute to look at. And you mentioned in this slide that mark-to-market accounting was not the cause of the credit crisis. Can you provide a little more color on that, on your opinions on that?
Right. Well, I mean, I'm an accounting purist, so I believe that if, in fact, there is a real mark-to-market, if there is a real market, that basically valuing financial assets on a mark-to-market basis is exactly what you should be doing. The problem came when you got to level two and level three where there weren't either liquid markets or observable inputs, as they say in the case of level three.
Right.
And I just sort of beep on my cordless. If I should lose you, I'm calling from my apartment. If I should lose you because my cordless dies, I will call back on my other cordless.
Okay.
I just realized my horror in my apartment, I don't have a landline or a regular non-cordless phone. But The problem becomes when management and trading desks and risk managers begin to take matters in their own hands and begin to, you know, put the inputs, variety of inputs, to come to a value. And that was the crux of the problem. You know, going back to the Enron problem, the problem was never marked to market with Enron. It was marked to model. Enron was long a lot of derivatives for which it was the only market maker, mm-hmm. in esoteric contracts for which, you know, they were providing power to Intel for 20 years from one power plant, and what was that worth? They had 50 variables that they put in their model. And as we see in these cases, when you dissect them and the smoke clears, in 99.9% of the cases, assets are overvalued. They're not undervalued. And that gets back to the incentives. But so the problem is not marked to market. The market was working. Now, people didn't exactly like the market,
right?
But it was working. I mean, there was a myth in late 09, early 09, that these markets were illiquid and they weren't functioning, and that's just not true. The problem was the banks just and the investment banks just didn't like where they were. I mean, the bid asks were wide, but FAS was pretty explicit. You had to mark to where you could exit the position, mm-hmm. which meant the offer side of the market or the bid side, depending whether you were long or short. And there were plenty of hedge funds, including us at the time, that actually had bids in on some of these assets in late 08 and early 09. And, you know, in reasonable size, but never got hit, mm-hmm. because the banks judged correctly that they would put political pressure through Congress on FASB to loosen the standards, mm-hmm. which is exactly what they've done.
Let me ask you a little bit about that. We've seen, you may be aware that earlier in the year we had a hearing that featured AIG, and within that featured the collateral call disputes between AIG and Goldman.
Right.
And one of part of the dispute between those two companies on what amount of collateral needed to be posted, if any, was just this. Was there, you know, the fact that there was not liquidity in the market, that there was a lack of price discovery, one, and then two, there were differences in the marks being estimated by Goldman and the marks estimated by other dealers, granted that you know, the other dealers were not quote unquote actionable marks. They were not willing to trade,
right.
at those marks.
That's a very big caveat, by the way.
Right, right. And that's why I said
business,
it.
Good till close. The quote is good till close.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you something, because I don't believe that there was any public disclosure of the collateral call dispute between Goldman and AIG until AIG filed their third quarter Q in October. And I don't know if you remember this, but do you recall whether or not it was known on the street?
It was not known on the street. That all was a surprise when the disclosures came.
Do you recall hearing it once it was disclosed? Do you recall hearing anything on the street about those disputes and you know, whether, you know, in hindsight now, you know, you've got these two different stories. On the one hand, you've got folks out there thinking that Goldman was purposely having their marks too low, and then on the other hand, there's folks saying no, Goldman had good marks and AIGs and their dealers were too high. Was there any you know, scuttlebutt on the street at the time that you recall?
Well, I mean, there was so much, Chris, there was so much going on in that October time frame when this all came out. It was just one of 40 stories.
Right.
It was hard to keep them all straight, so I don't recall. But, I mean, if the Lehman template is accurate, as well as the windup of some other institutions, it would seem to me that hindsight would tell us that Goldman's, as much as it may sometimes pain me, that Goldman's stance was accurate, was more accurate, i.e., this stuff was, that's where it was, that's what it was worth, and that then many of these things subsequently traded through those levels in early 09, and some of it is still below those levels, despite mm-hmm. the so-called recovery.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're still looking now at recoveries at Lehman Brothers. The last examiner's report the bankruptcy report I saw, you know, my $135 to $150 billion hole number now looks like it has to be closer to $190 billion. So, this stuff has continued to deteriorate. And again, not being an expert on the Goldman AIG dispute, it seems to me that the one party that was willing to you know, take action on it, as long as well as subsequent market history, tells us that that was the right side.
Mm-hmm. What about the next slide on your PowerPoint deck is, of course, the rating agencies. And, of course, we've done a lot of work on the rating agencies. But if you could just give me your opinions on their role in the crisis.
Well, I don't think I have much to add at this point. I think the rating agencies were compromised. The model was compromised. I mean, there's enough of an email trail from employees within the rating agencies themselves that tell that story. And I think, again, the whole idea was we started at the wrong end of the telescope, whereby the rating agencies should be looking at all the available data that they have and then deciding on what something should be rated. Instead, the system was set up as to how do we get a AAA rating. And that is a crucial difference.
Mm-hmm.
So deals were structured, promises made, who knows what else, to make sure that deals had a AAA tranche, as opposed to structuring a deal, putting the securities in it, and then having the rating agencies independently rate it.
Mm-hmm.
So when you come up with the idea that no deal will be done unless it has a AAA tranche, well, guess what? The deals will be done, so they have a AAA tranche.
Right.
And then, so again, the incentives were skewed, and the process was skewed.
Right, so let me ask you. I mean, a lot of folks that we've talked to, have certainly said, "Look, we relied on the ratings. We saw AAA. Supposedly sophisticated executives within investment banks, telling us, hey, all we did was retain the super senior, and everybody believed super senior was super safe." When you, in the 2000, 5, 6, 7, 8 time frame, and particularly, maybe not so much 8, was pretty evident by then, but in those prior 3 years, was it your experience that, sophisticated investors out there were simply looking at the AAA rating and saying everything's good, or did they recognize that there were problems with the rating agencies and not take those ratings at face value?
First of all, I wouldn't use sophisticated as an adjective. I would say investors, because any investor that simply said, well, I'm just relying on the ratings, is abrogating their fiduciary responsibility to do due diligence on behalf of their clients.
Mm-hmm.
And any serious amount of due diligence would have, even in 2005 and 2006, come up with some real problems in how these securities were being structured. I mean, people were writing about this certainly in 2006, about the problems with the securitization structure. But part of the driver was institutional, in that it was capital driven. As long as something was AAA, you didn't have to hold much capital or any against it, according to Basel II.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people that were buying the AAA tranches, simply because it was stamped AAA, said, well, since I don't have to hold capital against this, I can leverage this pretty much infinitely. And they thought they were embarked on a riskless arbitrage. They were financing themselves in the overnight market at very low money market rates and getting AAA securities that had 20, 30, sometimes 40 basis points in extra yield versus their fund.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all the work they did. Now, anybody that went to business school at any point in their career would say, well, wait a minute, there might not be a free lunch, and if I'm earning 20 or 30 or 40 basis points above other AAA securities, maybe there's a hidden risk here that I should explore. Well, it didn't seem like a lot of people did that in 2005 and 2006.
Mm-hmm.
That's as old as markets itself.
Right.
If yield is higher, the market is telling you something, not the ratings.
Mm-hmm. So, since we talked about Basel II, you mentioned another lesson learned in your PowerPoint deck is regulate the activities, not the actors. What role do you see regulation, or I guess maybe the lack thereof, in terms of contributing to the financial crisis, if any?
Well, this was a point I started making When Bill Donaldson first started suggesting hedge funds be registered, I think it was 04, 05, I started testifying before Congress. And one of my refrains was, back then, not specific to the mortgage crisis, was regulators should be regulating activities, not the activities, not the actors. And that is, bureaucratically, so many institutions have the silo mentality. I'm the Fed. I'm involved in regulating safety and soundness of banking. I'm the old FSLIC. I have to do savings and loan. I'm the SEC. I'm looking at mutual funds, so on, broker-dealers, so on and so forth. And they weren't understanding that there was a blurring of the lines in the securitization process, and that in fact they should be looking at the activity, securitization, and how that put risks through the system horizontally and not vertically. And I think that's one of the reasons the regulators in this instance were caught flat-footed, that we had a relatively new phenomenon, although securitizations were fairly old, but the growth of them was fairly new, and it cut across all kinds of lines, both banking, shadow banking, investment banks, hedge funds, insurance companies, and that was, I think, a fatal flaw in our regulatory system, because when everybody looked at their part of the elephant, they said, well, it was okay.
Mm-hmm. So let me, another thing we've seen is, you know, a lot, of course, we've seen the huge growth in the mortgage industry, the expansion of types of product out there, you know, with higher and higher loan-to-value ratios, higher DTI, sure. Lower FICO scores, you know, whatever the various, whatever risk sure. layer you want to layer. And it appears, you know, that part of that story is the originate-to-distribute model. And that is, you know, the mortgage originators appeared to simply be underwriting to whatever the secondary market would take, which yep. apparently was just about anything.
Yep.
And, you know, so that the mortgage originator wouldn't have skin in the game, the securitizer investment bank wouldn't have any skin in the game. The only folks with skin in the game was the ultimate investor who apparently was relying on a AAA rating.
Or not accounting for the toxic piece correctly.
Right, right. And so, again, I guess, you know, what role do you see, if any, I think this is also in our statute, of the whole growth in the securitization and specifically the originate-to-distribute model? Do you see that as being part of the problem?
Well, I never see the instruments themselves as problems, because none of these instruments, by and large, are new. I mean, puts and calls were started in the Amsterdam market in the 17th century, for example, and securitizations have been around for a long time as well. Lou Ranieri was in the 80s, I think, that we started the mortgage-backed market at Salomon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what happens is that instruments get abused or are used to fraudulently, you know, steal money or whatever the case might be, and that's the problem. Derivatives and securitization aren't inherently evil onto themselves, but in the hands of dishonest and evil people, they can wreak enormous harm due to the nature of what they are, and that's the problem. The securitization market became a monster because exactly of what we talked about a few minutes ago, was that the ratings agencies got complicit and enabled large institutions to gobble up the AAA tranches with no capital and ostensibly thinking they had found a free lunch, and where the risky part of the tranches were retained in institutions that didn't account for them properly. And this enabled the game to go on. But if you had real skin in the game, by having to retain interest and then reserve against them properly, nobody would have bought these mortgage securities. No one would have done them. Lehman Brothers and Merrill would have never originated, would have never distributed this stuff, because they would have immediately had to take a profit hit every time they did a deal. And that would have ended it. The incentives working the proper way would have ended this, you know, well before it got out of control. So I can't stress enough how much the accounting matters to this, because if that had stopped, none of this would have happened.
Mm-hmm. What about, you know, another thing we were looking at and trying to figure out is when you get into 06, 07, it looks like, you know, one, a lot of the buyers of CDO tranches appear to be other CDOs. And two, you have what appears to be an increase in a number of synthetic deals. And then three, even though AIG had purportedly stopped writing CDS on subprime super senior CDOs, in the years prior to 06, and really since 04, you know, you had a pretty large growth in the CDS derivative. And there's at least been some thought out there that the growth of the CDS derivative prolonged the housing bubble, you know, contributed to additional securitizations coming on the market. Do you have any views on that?
My theory is, and I don't have, and it's just a theory, is that despite all that I've said, I'm guessing risk managers and outside auditors probably began to get uncomfortable with the amount of risk that some of the institutions with retained interest were beginning to take. And so the directive probably came, we got to find new ways if we want to keep this game going in how we warehouse this stuff. So the two obvious solutions were synthetics, where CDOs were buying, you know, CDOs, and then the application of wholesale insurance. Well, we have a guarantee from a AAA. So even if the world comes to an end, we're going to be fine. And this, again, was fraught with, you know, all the obvious risks. And if the insurance company is writing insurance on the entire world coming to an end, and things get bad, your insurance may not be worth anything. But again, you know, so I think that even if you looked at the level 2 and level 3 numbers, even at the end of 05, that were on the books here at some of these firms, and then certainly at the end of 06, I've got to think, and it's one of the reasons why I think everybody was complicit in this, because I suspect that people began to have conversations, look, you know, we're leveraged 10 to 1 in level 3 assets in the real estate market, so, you know, we really probably prudently shouldn't be taking on any more of this. And we better find another way, because this is the golden goose, this is where we're making our money, to keep the business going, but keep this off our books.
Mm-hmm.
And thus the search for other methods with which to either warehouse or insure the product.
And again, thinking back to the 07 time frame, I want to ask you about what was known then by like folks like yourself and other market participants. And let me give you an example. You know, on October 24th, 2007 was the date that Merrill came out and said, hey, we're taking a $7.9 billion write-down on our super senior tranches and other subprime exposures after 2.5 weeks earlier saying it was going to be 4.5. And during the conference call, the analysts were saying, okay, that's all fine and good, and you've given us your net write-downs and your net exposures. We'd like to know what your gross write-downs and your gross exposures were to have a better idea of what's, you know, really on your books. And then CFO Edwards and then CEO O'Neill said, well, that's a fine and dandy request. We're not going to tell you anything. And then when Mr. Thain comes in to replace Mr. O'Neill and they have their 4Q07 conference call in January of 08, you know, lo and behold, the gross exposures are quite large, and they're also recording credit valuation allowances on guarantee insurance purchased from less than financially capable monolines.
Right. Exactly. So it gets right to that narrative.
So do folks, did you and other folks know in the 07 time frame that that a lot of these companies, you know, again, lack of transparency by reporting net, and two, that the reason for that was they were providing credit, they were buying credit insurance, but there was questions about perhaps, you know, about counterparty risk and how good that credit insurance was?
We didn't really know that till the fall of 07, Chris, with the Merrill and the UBS types of disclosures.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it became apparent that even the net numbers were bad enough,
right,
but that they were probably far worse than what we, you know, we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
So that with the use of credit insurance and other vehicles, that in fact the gross numbers, you know, were in fact ones we should be focusing, or at least know, and that the firms were not really, you know, really wanted in any position to tell the market that. So it wasn't until the fall of 07, I think, that the market kind of picked up on that, and said, oh my God, there's another layer here that we didn't even consider.
Right. Now, the another factor that you had in your lessons about the financial crisis had to do with the value at risk or the VAR models. Where and of course we understand what a VAR model is and that black swans do exist, Six Sigma events do occur. And your third bullet in this slide is, you know, VAR models work well in theory. The reality is often quite different. Again, just a little more color on what you thought was the problem with the value at risk models.
Well, I'll preface by saying that I'm not a risk manager. However, the VAR model, when you need it at the most, continually broke down, apparently, by using traditional normal statistical, skews, as opposed to the more observed fat tail phenomena that we keep coming into, that in fact observable inputs are all good until those that are responsible for the inputs all act the same way, and based on the observations, the Heisenberg principle applied to finance, and that observing all this stuff could have an impact itself by one's actions following the observations, and the complacency that the VAR models brought in effect was adding to the fault line risk. Mm-hmm. So VAR in and of itself, I think, was hopelessly outmoded for what happened. I mean, it helps you 99% of the time, and on the 1% time it blows you up. Mm-hmm. And that just is not acceptable to any sort of thinking market participant. Mm-hmm. From a risk point of view.
So in terms
of VAR got people into that mode of thinking. And people that didn't know what was going on in the portfolios, because we're all lazy, just simply looked at the VAR figure, and management will present it to the boards and to investors, and people say, oh, well, we're not taking a lot of risks, without trying to understand what was behind the VAR model, what the inputs were.
Right. So in terms of both VAR models measuring, what kind of volatility there could be in a company's profits in a day or a month if certain events happen, and also just asset valuation models overall, I would be a very rich man if I had gotten a nickel over the last year for the number of people who have told me, nobody anticipated housing prices were going to go down 30 or 40%. And that's what caused the financial crisis, and that's all that caused the financial crisis. How do you respond to that comment?
Anybody running a Monte Carlo simulation would have immediately had a heart attack if they saw the risks that their portfolio was taking based on, a different risk model. And why risk managers didn't run that, is beyond me. And if they did, they certainly seem to have kept it quiet. Mm-hmm. Because that would have shown you immediately that random distributions outside of a forecast distribution might give you extremely different results. And the finance market is nobody nobody in 2000 thought the Nasdaq could go down 70%, and no one thought that. Anyone would let anyone leverage up the long-term government bond market 100-1 in 1998, and there's all kinds of things that can never happen that happen all the time, and anybody giving you that excuse is I think derelict in duty at the very least.
Was it? Do you know? Again, thinking back to at the time and what you were hearing or knew about as a market participant, but was it known then that it at least sounds like from what I've at least heard from a lot of folks that whether it's a VAR model or an asset valuation model or any kind of forecasting model, they were just not building in those kinds of Monte Carlo simulations or those kinds of assumptions in that would predict. More than maybe a 5 or 10% housing price decline, but I haven't heard anyone doing beyond that.
No, and despite the fact that housing prices went up 100%, in the immediate period preceding it, so or 80 or 90, whatever it was, mm-hmm. And so putting that alone in your model that housing prices had just gone up by a lot more than anyone had ever thought would have brought you to the inescapable conclusion that they can go down. More than you ever thought, but again, it was a one-way skew. Now, compounding this problem was there was a very notable book written in, what, 05 or 06 by Richard Bookstaver, A Devil of Our Own Design, who's now at the SEC. Mm-hmm. And he was a risk manager at Morgan Stanley and FrontPoint. And he wrote exactly a whole book about this issue that probably every risk manager should have read, about why the VAR models were insufficient and why the fat tail continued to be a problem. Nassim Taleb had already written Fooled by Randomness at that point, which was the Black Swan was basically just a revised version of Fooled by Randomness, which he just kept pointing out over and over and over again the financial market instances of fat tail occurrences and how they wiped out traders. Now, they had not really wiped out firms, he said, but he gave all kinds of evidence about how they used to always wipe out traders, particularly hedge fund traders. So there was a body already out there of people writing intelligently about risk models well before this happened.
Mm-hmm.
So yes. For people to simply say, well, no one could have told, and we didn't know how, it's ridiculous.
Right, right. And we are familiar with those books and those individuals. So the next thing you had in your PowerPoint deck was Glass-Steagall, and that they were right after all. Any additional color to what's in the slide on that?
Not really. I mean, that in fact, the commercial bank model that basically got into investment banking, and I started looking at it that way, not the other way around, how the investment banks had to become commercial banks to fund themselves. But the business of commercial banks getting into investment banking and holding on to securities for investment accounts as opposed to the credit underwriting model, we felt was problematic. And in fact, it was exactly those banks that got most aggressive in that area that proved to be the most problematic. Leave it at that.
I take it when you say became problematic, you mean problematic for the commercial banks that got into it, yes?
Yes, yes.
Did you see any? I will tell you, I have heard from some other folks that have said the commercial banks getting into the securitization business and the investment banking business in general, since they had lower cost and stickier funding sources, deposits,
right,
as opposed to repos, commercial paper, medium term notes,
right,
et cetera, that the investment banks had, also contributed to the investment banks, therefore taking on additional risk, growing at highly leveraged growth rates to compete. Did you see that? Have you heard that?
I think that's exactly what I'm talking about. That exactly follows my point.
Okay. Your next slide talks about too big to fail, which, as I think I said in the opening, was something that we have also, one, it's in the statute, and two, we've looked at too big to fail both by looking at Lehman Brothers, that I think some people may think actually was too big to fail, even though it failed, and Wachovia, since it was the bank that at least the FDIC first invoked the systemic risk exception, although, of course, Wells came in after the fact and made
right.
that somewhat moot. But your slide indicates that, you know, if you're too big to fail, you're too big to exist, and that taxpayers, of course, bear the ultimate risk, which, of course, we all saw with the failure of Lehman and other banks getting TARP because they were too big to fail. And again, just same question, any additional color on that?
Well, you know, the whole idea of too big to fail, it gets back to the role of the government and central bank in these periods. And I think that my problem, my concern, is that of the moral hazard concern, and that is, if you go back to Walter Badgett and his sort of rules on Lombard Street in the 19th century about the central bank's role in being a lender of last resort, I mean, if you have to do it, you do it with the following provisos. You remove the board of directors, you fire senior management, you stop all dividending, and you penalize the common equity holders and subordinated debt holders, and to some extent the senior debt holders, as punishment for the government providing its financing. And over and over and over again, we kept violating that sort of sound set of common sense principles if the taxpayer is at risk. And I think it's unfortunately, politically, and it's beyond the scope of your purview, it's what's still coloring the view of Wall Street and banks today by the public. And I think that there was a strong sense that if you didn't do that and yet provided backstop financing and guarantees by the government, that without a penalty in the marketplace, institutions would, within some reasonable time frame, you know, act similarly again, holding, you know, in the great image of Blazing Saddles, you know, one more move and then he gets it, with a guy holding a gun to his own head.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you've really got to look at that whole concept, that if institutions get in that position and they're too systemically large and we don't have the political will to dismantle them, that when the taxpayer needs to come to the rescue again, as he or she will inevitably will, that we punish those that put the institutions in that position. And there seems to me to be no willingness to do that. So that's why the too-big-to-fail mechanism is fatally flawed right now in Western economies. Don't want to punish those that put the taxpayer at risk.
Mm-hmm.
In many cases on these deals, there's always one investor at the table who doesn't know he's at the table, and that's the taxpayer.
Right.
And since we get nothing for them, you can understand why taxpayers around the world increasingly feel agitated.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the more core aspects of this crisis that I think is staggering to some of us that hasn't been fixed.
So let me add, one of the things we did when we were looking at Too Big to Fail and Lehman in particular was we were talking to a lot of folks, you know, whether they were, you know, buyers of commercial paper, whether they were providing repo financing to Lehman, whether they were hedge funds with prime brokerage accounts, or even the J.P. Morgans or Bonies of the world that provided the intraday repo
right.
credit. Was asking, you know, essentially, look, how did you go about managing that exposure, and did your views on whether or not whether or not Lehman would fail or be allowed to fail impact that at all? And many, probably most, said, yes, we thought either Lehman wouldn't fail, that they'd get a private deal done, or that the government would come in and at least provide for some type of orderly wind down. So some of them therefore said, so we left everything in there, like the reserve primary fund that got hit and broke the buck. And others said, well, we thought that, but, you know, still we couldn't risk it, you know, so at least towards the end, we started to, you know, reduce our exposures because once it got into September, it wasn't exactly sure whether or not the government would save them or not. But what did you see, if anything, in terms of investors in the Lehman's and the other quote-unquote too-big-to-fail institutions about which there was, you know, concerns about them perhaps surviving?
Well, again, the I'm not a money market trader. Again, I'm an equity trader. But we looked at Bear Stearns, and, you know, someone came in with assistance, so there a smaller institution was rescued, in effect. So you had that template, despite a lot of warnings, by the way, and everyone forgets this. There were a lot of warnings by Treasury over the summer of 2008 that it might not be there for every institution. I remember that vividly.
Right.
That Paulson made that reasonably clear, as much as a Treasury Secretary could make that clear, that not all institutions, you know, may receive a bailout. And I think people kind of forget that in the narrative, but that was out there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was out there as early as the first and second week of September, too,
right.
as I recall.
Right.
So you were warned, number one. Number two, I think that certain players had certain beliefs, and the higher you're up on the capital structure you were, the more you felt you weren't taking a lot of risk. You might be taking time risk, but if you were a commercial paper lender to Lehman or you figured, well, there were enough assets there for me. Now, Lehman was such a basket case that may have proved ex post facto to not be the case, but a reasonable person could have held that assumption. But there really was, no one should have had any doubt that there could have been a question by the third week of September that not every institution would be saved. For anyone to think that was whistling past the graveyard.
Mm-hmm. And putting aside the issue of, you know, well, maybe not putting aside, but understanding that, you know, taxpayers get hurt when too big to fail institutions are not allowed to fail. Do you have any opinions on whether or not Lehman should have been allowed to fail, given what appears to have been a pretty bad fallout from the bankruptcy?
Well, I think that the answer is, I think, in hindsight, my own view was, I think it was one of the best things that happened in the whole crisis, because it finally put some market discipline and put fear into people that had never had to have worried about looking at things other than a rating or a general view that the government will always be there, that in fact it added risk back in the marketplace. And I think that, you know, there's been some evidence, by the way, that's come out from the Fed in the last month or two, that the interbank market did not seize up to the extent that people thought it did in October, November, December, and early 2009. It's a very interesting study. I don't know if you guys have seen it. That in fact, a lot of this was mythology. That, in fact, the interbank market was, in many cases, certainly on a distributed, was still functioning for healthy institutions. And that, in fact, that Lehman, you know, did put a reasonable amount of the torpedo into the ship of moral hazard. But, you know, then we came right back right after and rescued AIG and kind of unraveled all the market discipline that Lehman might have brought. And I think that was the cross purposes. After Lehman, everybody blinked again and said, okay, well, we need, you know, the thing broke a buck and we need to restructure this properly. But again, they didn't do it the way it should have been done, and that is, fire the board of directors, fire senior management. You know, if you need to do this, and we need to save senior creditors and depositors and commercial paper holders, okay, we understand that's necessary for commerce, but we do not need to save the investors. And that's, again, where I think we took another wrong turn in this whole process.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, so your next slide talks about capitalism on the upside and socialism on the downside is bad policy, and how hands-off regulation of markets until Wall Street needs a hand, crony capitalism, Wall Street versus Main Street, etc. So I guess this sort of goes to the issue of just lack of regulation in the good times. But same question, Mr. Chanos. You know, any additional color on this slide?
No, I think we did that covers some of what we've just talked about. That,
right.
That in fact, the taxpayers at the table an awful lot of time when he or she doesn't even know they're at the table.
Mm-hmm. And then your next slide talks about quantitative easing and helicopter finance having a cost. And let me just tell you, in discussions we've had, well, in some of the discussions we've had with some folks, we have learned that apparently the policy at the Fed was, and apparently it still is, although maybe it's come off a little bit, is, we don't use monetary policy to burst bubbles, but we use monetary policy to stabilize markets after the bubble bursts. What do you think about that policy, one, and two, any additional color on helicopter finance slide?
Well, the helicopter finance part is politics, and that's beyond the purview of our discussion, I think.
Okay.
But the asymmetric view that the Fed has, that we are here... that we are here to help you when things fall apart, but we really don't. We're sort of agnostic on when the bubble is blowing up, being filled, but we're there to pick up the pieces when it bursts. Has some inherent of logical flaw, shall we say?
Right.
Not the least of which is, well, how do you know that the bubble is completely burst when you're coming in? How do you know it's burst at all? If you couldn't identify it on the way up, how are you identifying it properly on the way down? And all of those sort of conundrums. And it gets back to the view of what was called conveniently the Greenspan put,
right,
in the 90s, was that the Fed would always be there in the form of easing anytime the markets weakened. And now you know, we call it quantitative easing or whatever you want to call it, helicopter finance. But the view continues to be that the taxpayer, basically in the form of a dilution of the dollar and printing of money, stands by to clean up any mess that Wall Street might foist on it through the mechanism of the Federal Reserve, mm-hmm. as opposed to the Treasury. And this obviously runs enormous tipping point risks, because it all works until it doesn't. You can continue to print money as long as the populace agrees that it's not a problem, but the minute they do believe it's a problem, you have Zimbabwe. And if you could print your way to prosperity, Zimbabwe would be the wealthiest country in the world right now. But you can't, ultimately. But you can do it for a while. Mm-hmm. And that is a risk, a fat tail risk, I think, that the Fed is running, that it doesn't put in its models, or at least doesn't admit to putting in its models, to use the securitization analogy.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you something.
Again, that's beyond the purview of this discussion.
Right. So let me ask you something else about Fed policy that I was just reading about in some countrywide conference call transcripts in 07, when, you know, it was before they had gotten hit with the liquidity crisis in August, but like in their first quarter 07 and second quarter 07 earnings calls, Mr. Mazzillo was talking about the fact that, you know, in the prior, I guess ever since 2004, you know, the Fed had, raised the discount rate 17 times, and then had recently come out, I think it was late in 06, with the non-traditional mortgage guidance that said, look, you've got to qualify borrowers at fully indexed rates as opposed to teaser rates, amongst other things. And he said in that conference call that, you know, that was a problem because, one, you know, the Fed had earlier said, and I think Greenspan said this, you know, look, you can refi to get money out of your house, and you should do that with adjustable rate loans because they're better. And you know, so he said, look, the Fed was raising rates, understanding a majority of the loans out there were adjustable rate. And two, by issuing the guidance, it meant, you know, they knew that a lot of these borrowers that got into the 228s and the 327s and the pay option arms and et cetera weren't going to be able to refi either before or when the reset date came, and that it was really, you know, a Fed problem, or at least a Fed contributing to the problem, as opposed to the kind of product that was underwritten beforehand. Any comment on that?
Well, I mean, so if I'm getting what you're saying correctly, that their sort of comment was, well, that we never counted, the market never counted interest rates ever going up. I mean, or going up within, you know, any kind of time period. Is that what in effect Mazzillo was saying?
I don't know if I would go that far in saying what Mazzillo was saying. I think what he was saying is the Fed knew that most folks were in adjustable rate loans, and that if you were going to continually increase rates and then increase the guidance for underwriting, that they knew that borrowers were going to be unable to refi, and that was going to, you know, create delinquency and foreclosure problems. As opposed to, in the past, you know, qualifying people at a 1% teaser rate or whatever it may be, right? I mean, I found it an interesting comment myself, and I just wanted to get somebody else's take on it.
Yeah. Well, remember that at some point during the Greenspan period, he had said, you know, didn't he even advise people to take out an adjustable rate mortgage?
Yeah, right. And that
I think he did right before rates went up.
Right,
as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, counting on the Fed's forecasting ability, I think, is an abrogation of any corporate board or risk management, because they don't have a very good track record themselves. Not in calling turning points, so I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Again, of course, as we get to the end of your PowerPoint presentation from last October, you say, finally, shooting the messengers does not change reality. Short sellers play a vital role in exposing excessive risk within the financial system in real time. And you make the other points. Short selling is something in our statute that we are told to look at. And given that you manage a $7 billion fund for that is primarily a short selling fund. I suspect you have some additional color on this.
I do, and I've written op-eds on it. I can send you as well. But the interesting thing was when the Bear Stearns crisis hit, there was a flock of bankers, and I know this because it was reported back to me contemporaneously from friends on the Hill, that went down to Washington in the late March and early April time frame to meet with Paulson and senators and the SEC and Treasury. And the two things that they basically asked for, and this was a number of bankers, Dick Fuld and others, was number one, you've got to do something about short selling in our shares, that there's a conspiracy out there to drive down the stocks of financial institutions like ours. And number two, you've got to loosen this FAS 157 accounting. So the two things that the bankers asked for was not maybe a relaxation of the capital standards, not perhaps accept our apologies for putting the system in this horrible state of risk and putting the taxpayer at risk, not apologizing for their shoddy bookkeeping, ridiculous leverage, or so on and so forth. It was, let's stop short selling and silence the accountants. That ought to tell you all you need to know. When I say shooting the messenger, it was all about trying to keep this from the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And I think that in many cases they were successful by, as we've seen in a relaxation of FAS 157 in April of 2009, I think a questionable set of stress tests in early 2009, and by the bans in short selling that occurred in the fall of 2008 that had not one impact on what was going on. Mm-hmm. So I think that these things speak for themselves. There's been one empirical study after another that's come out on the short-selling bans that I don't need to go over that just simply said, short-selling had nothing to do with this. But yet, there was part of the narrative. Excuse me, one second.
Sure.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
But we've seen one empirical study after another that said the short-selling bans did nothing in the marketplace. In many of the large financial institutions, short interest was dropping as 2008 went on, not increasing. And finally, as I kept pointing out, that a large amount of the short activity in these institutions that ended up in terminal phase, like Bear Stearns or Lehman, Fannie Mae, was due to institutions that were long illiquid or unmarketable instruments that were desperately trying to hedge their risk in either the CDS market or the equity market. Mm-hmm. So if I was a Bear Stearns real estate client and Bear Stearns had agreed to finance my real estate project, I had a commitment from Bear Stearns. That was a non-marketable asset, if you will, particularly in the spring of 2008 when credit was drying up for real estate projects. If Bear Stearns wasn't around to honor that commitment, my project might fail. So it would be very smart for me to look at the CDS market or the equity market and possibly hedge off some of that exposure in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And I saw this in the Enron collapse, where energy traders were aggressively trying to short Enron stock, and even back then buy CDS protection in the nascent CDS market on Enron as it became apparent that there was problems at Enron. Same thing at the banks. Most of this activity, if you investigate it, was large institutions trying to hedge off their counterparty risk or hedge off non-marketable, illiquid exposures to these institutions. Mm-hmm. And of course, we have all the investigations going on that I guess are still ongoing on collusion and rumor mongering and all that, but to the best of my knowledge, they've not found anything, and I doubt they will find anything.
And that you anticipated perhaps my next question is, we do know from Shapiro being at our very first hearing that the SEC was, or is, certainly was, and maybe still is, investigating potential short selling, particularly during the crisis, and I think particularly in March 2008 about Bear and September 2008 about
yes.
September.
Yes.
Did the SEC come? I mean, word has it, and that they went to the hedge funds. Did you guys get contacted by the SEC for as any part of those investigations?
Well, Well, I don't comment on SEC investigations, okay. But I think it would be safe to say that any large hedge fund or short seller was contacted by a number of regulatory agencies in 08 about their activities. Mm-hmm. And that would be more than fair to say that. How's that?
But that's fair. And I certainly haven't seen anything in the public domain about your fund being sued or anything by the SEC or anything. So that, I haven't missed anything, have I?
You haven't missed anything.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is that short selling, because of the additional need to borrow the securities, has the longest paper trail of any financial transaction. And when we talk about market rumors and collusive behavior, and remember, trading on or inducing others to trade on information you know to be false is securities fraud. That's the violation. So in today's era of emails and IMs and tape trader conversations, if there was a conspiracy to drive down Bear Stearns stock by planting false rumors or Lehman Brothers or any of these, Inspector Clouseau could solve this case.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that hard. And the fact of the matter is, so far we've seen no evidence 2 years later. And given the priority that this was to the SEC, because everybody jumped on that bandwagon, and the FSA, at the request of HBOS in the UK, launched an investigation in April of 08 on a market drop in HBOS, which of course subsequently needed to be rescued due to its bad loans. And in June of 08, came out and said they went through 10,000 records and trading records and IMs and emails and didn't find one shred of evidence. However, they said, that's not to say nothing happened. We don't know. But we didn't find any evidence.
Right.
And so that's the only public body, to my knowledge, that's actually come out and said something about an investigation on this. The SEC has kept quiet. But one would think this would have been a priority. And the fact that they still haven't announced anything and that records were subpoenaed back in 08 would tell me that probably a high probability that these conspiracies did not exist.
Mm-hmm. So other than what we've talked about, any other thoughts or opinions on causes of the financial crisis?
I think we've done a pretty good job in covering the territory.
I think so. Okay, well, we've been going for an hour and 20 minutes, so I think, unless there's anything else, I think we're done.
All right. Well, again, if you have any follow-up or anything, just